Welcome to Prostate Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Maha Hussain, and to begin, she presented a patient from her practice.
So this is a 61-year-old gentleman with a original history of December 2017, clinical T2-M1 Gleason 7 prostate cancer. Interestingly, his PSA was only 7.9. His imaging basically revealed oligometastatic disease only in the right acetabulum. Generally speaking, when I actually see patients who have isolated lesion that is suspicious, which can make a difference from a prognostic perspective, but definitely from a treatment perspective, I tend to want to prove, in fact, are we dealing with metastatic disease? So in his case, actually, we put him through a biopsy through interventional radiology, and in fact, metastatic disease was confirmed. So he was started on LHRH therapy, and I usually start these patients with just the LHRH in the beginning, allow them a month to kind of digest everything, settle through their first month of treatment, and then discuss the potential for therapy intensification. And in his case, generally speaking, because he's technically low-volume disease, in the low-volume patients, I usually offer AR-targeted therapy as opposed to chemotherapy, primarily because of the data from CHARTED, which demonstrated, again, that the benefit from chemo was predominantly in the high-volume disease, and the patients who technically had low-volume disease did not seem to benefit from the chemotherapy. So at the time we started, the data was available from LATITUDE, which is a randomized trial of LHRH therapy with or without abiraterone and prednisone. He started that, and then we generally, when there is a bit of an unusual case, we generally present those kind of cases to the GU-Oncology Tumor Board, and the case was discussed, and because he had such minimal disease overall, the recommendation was to consider part of the therapy intensification is local therapy, and in his case, actually, he underwent radical prostatectomy with pelvic lymph node dissection. Interestingly, his pathology was pathologic T2N0 and Gleason 6 disease, recognizing fully that obviously this was after several months of starting hormone therapy. And so whether he got downstaged at the level of the prostatic lesion, lymph node situation, and whether the Gleason score is impacted by that. He received also targeted RT to the acetabular lesion. And this is sort of a new area of research that's going on with regard to targeting oligometastatic metastases. He is thus far with an undetectable PSA, PSA of zero. His recent imaging actually is fantastic, demonstrating complete resolution of the bone lesion that we saw on previous bone scan. So I'm happy to stop here, but definitely I can tell you what I'm thinking in cases like these.
Well, I'm really interested to know what you're thinking. I've got about 50 questions for you. The first one is, you mentioned the fact that at surgery he had Gleason 6, and I'm curious, do you see downstaging of the primary when you give systemic therapy, when you give endocrine therapy?
You know, I must admit that I have not had many cases like this. This one is, I find, a bit unusual. As you recall, there were many trials in the past that had looked at neoadjuvant hormone therapy prior to radical prostatectomy. And I must admit, I have not gone back to review them to see the concordance between the biopsy diagnosis and Gleason score versus the postoperative Gleason score. But at the end of the day, he did have M1. It's almost irrelevant, I would argue, what the Gleason score is, since he already has biopsy-proven bony metastases.
I mean, I was just curious because I hadn't even thought about it. And the other question I was thinking about is, how often do you see Gleason 6 in a patient presenting with metastatic disease? Is there any correlation?
Well, so the Gleason 6 generally, if you think about it from a newly diagnosed cases, these are the patients that potentially have the option of active surveillance, recognizing fully that, again, in this gentleman, he was treated, and it was several months after treatment that the pathology could have been impacted by the fact that he received several months of very potent hormonal therapy. But I think a Gleason 6 disease, I've seen very few cases based on a biopsy, not a radical prostatectomy, where the patient was on active surveillance, went on for about a year or so, PSA goes up, re-biopsied, and now they have actually more significant disease, and then prostatectomy is done. But situation like this, I have not seen many.
So he was actually Gleason 7, I guess, a diagnosis that wasn't that much different. Why did he get the imaging? Did he have any pain or symptoms?
He came to me with imaging already. And again, he's a Gleason 7, PSA was 7.9. If you think about it, that wasn't terribly elevated. But for whatever reason, his primary managing physician elected to do the imaging. And in some way, I'm glad for his sake that the imaging got done.
Really?
Yes.
Yeah, no, it's a very interesting case. Another thing that sort of comes up almost through the back end here is the question of, even if he didn't have oligometastatic disease and you weren't going to treat it, is there a role for treating the primary in a patient with metastatic disease? The data that I've seen, I think there was some data related to radiation, but I don't know whether the same thing kind of would apply to surgery. Pretty radical idea, but what about this idea of, I don't know whether it's a debulking thing or whatever, that you get a benefit of treating the primary metastatic disease?
And I think this is an excellent point, because this is, in fact, the subject of active prospective clinical trials, the whole issue of targeting the primary. And you're absolutely correct. The Stampede data that looked at a very, very large cohort, and they went back and looked at patient stratification based on volume of disease, and demonstrated that, in fact, the patients who had a lower volume disease and they were randomized to the combination of systemic therapy plus radiation to the primary had an overall survival advantage by comparison to the patients who did not get that. The data does not seem to be the case in the situation of patients with high volume disease. I think it is multifactorial, but I would say, as you know, the prostate continues to be the source of the seeds, so to speak. And clearly the seeds that travel can be potentially eradicated in areas when you target, but that doesn't mean the prostate stops sending seeds out there. So I think in situations where there is really low volume disease, and I would say low volume, one has to be very careful about what we call low volume. It ought to be low volume and low risk. I would say somebody with two hepatic lesions is totally different than a patient with two pelvic bone lesions. And so this is specifically looking at lower risk, so to speak, low volume patients, where I think there is the merit. In this case, actually, I was one of those physicians who were more erring on the side of surgery as opposed to radiation. Normally, I would err on the side of radiation, and partly because he had such an isolated lesion that if it wasn't for a bone scan, would have been completely missed. And since that lesion could be, in fact, nailed with radiation, the hope was that by debulking the cancer completely, we would actually have a better chance at rendering him perhaps tumor-free. And in these patients, what we're discussing, and I would like to reference your audience to a recent publication in JCO that we submitted, talking about therapy intensification and therapy de-intensification as opposed to intermittent therapy, with the idea that once you hammer the cancer as hard as you can, perhaps after a finite duration of treatment, sort of a la adjuvant therapy, 2-3 years of treatment, one can consider stopping the treatment and allowing the patients hopefully a prolonged therapy-free interval and perhaps cure as we develop better and better systemic therapies.
When you think about this case, to me, the most controversial thing is what you were just talking about, which is using surgery in this patient as opposed to radiation therapy. It implies that you think that it's more effective. Do you think it is?
No, I think it has to do with the tumor bulk. And in this gentleman's case, he practically had technically a T2 disease that was by all criteria clinically confined. It wasn't like bulky local disease. And then the PSA wasn't very high. His imaging suggested negative gross imaging. And so I think in his case, we discussed both options. And again, that's what I would encourage the audience to ensure that these types of cases are discussed at a multidisciplinary conference where there's radiation oncologist, medical oncologist, and urologist. And this is unlike, for example, other cases that I've had when we discussed them, and the overall opinion was that the patient is better off going with radiation as opposed to surgery in the context of an oligometastatic disease. As I mentioned, there are several clinical trials that are ongoing right now. Some are strictly with radiation, some allow surgery, and I think it's going to be interesting to see what the sort of verdict from these prospective trials will be.
It will really be interesting. So this case is a very unusual, interesting example of endocrine-sensitive metastatic disease. Can you talk a little bit about where we are with data on this question? You mentioned the CHAARTED trial, and then now subsequently there have been a number of other phase 3 trials. What do we know about adding things on to androgen deprivation?
This is actually fantastic. We are, I would say, in an unprecedented era. Those who would remember the days of the 80s and the 90s will very well remember the concept of combined androgen deprivation with LHRH therapy targeting the testis or with orchiectomy plus oral therapy with an antiandrogen. And I'm sure your audience remember flutamide and bicalutamide and nalutamide and so on. And if you go back to those data in totality, the data was kind of what I would say quasi-positive. In some trials, there was definitely a survival advantage. In others, there wasn't. Several meta-analyses were conducted, and at the end of the day, there was a net effect of benefit of combined androgen deprivation. So we're sort of reliving that cycle. Similarly, chemotherapy was tested with hormone therapy in the 80s and 90s, and there are many, many clinical trials, and the chemotherapy of the time had really no clear advantage in that regard. So as a principle, in terms of maximizing treatment with either double targeting for AR or multi-targeting with AR targeting plus chemotherapy, is a concept that has been evaluated. We just so happen to have much better drugs as we have right now.
It's funny when you're mentioning these historical things is bringing back memories to me. And I don't know why, because I think it was when we first got involved with CME on prostate cancer, there was this gigantic, like 9,000 patient trial looking at high dose bicalutamide.
Yeah.
Around that time.
You remember those days?
Well, barely. So yeah, that was sort of the first wave. And then you didn't hear anything for years.
Correct.
And then all of a sudden things started happening, I guess maybe 5 years ago.
You're absolutely correct. There was a lot of interest in multiple things. One of them also was to avoid castration by itself with the use of high dose antiandrogens, as you were mentioning. And again, there was even testing with a drug called Suramin. I don't know if you remember that or not. We tested it in SWOG in a phase 2 trial. So there was a lot of testing that occurred historically to try to maximize the anti-tumor strategy. I think the advantage of better drugs is very clear. So where we are right now is we have 4 different randomized phase 3 clinical trials that demonstrate that a multi-targeted strategy with chemotherapy plus hormonal therapy is of benefit. The lead, I would say, is in terms of the design and everything else, is CHAARTED. There's obviously Zhitag also and Stampede also reaffirming the benefit of chemo. However, I would like to point your audience is that when we designed CHAARTED, it was designed with a certain thing in mind, is to look at whether the disease prognostic features, as in the volume of cancer and its location, whether that in fact impacts on the outcomes, because there was many data from intergroup SWOG-led clinical trials evaluating LHRH therapy or orchiectomy with or without an antiandrogen, demonstrating that in fact location matters, and data from MD Anderson indicating that the number of lesions in addition to the locations is a factor. And so we kind of combined these two criteria to come up with the CHAARTED design. And as I said earlier, that the updated data that was presented at GU ASCO and was published reaffirmed the fact that the number of lesions, the volume of disease and its location has an impact, and there's no clear advantage in the low volume, low risk patients.
Could I just clarify one thing about that? And you referred to it earlier when you were talking about the case. And I have to say that, you know, for the general medical oncologist who has a long history dealing with breast cancer, and the whole concept of relative risk reduction, which you then apply in breast cancer to the absolute risk, that's kind of been ingrained in us for a long time. And when things like CHAARTED came along, to me, it kind of didn't make sense. It seemed like the lower volume disease, maybe, you know, the absolute benefit might be different or might be lower, but it still seemed like logical that the relative risk would still kind of be the same. Is that not the case?
That's really not the case. And this is updated data that I believe it was published and presented at an earlier GU ASCO. And I think biologically, and again, I am right now sort of more thinking loud, but I don't have 100% proof. Having said that, I think biologically it may make sense, which is basically the disease that tends to be more mellow, maybe much more AR-driven, as opposed to a disease that is behaving in a more aggressive manner and sort of the renegade kind of manner, where not everything in it is AR-driven. And I think that could be one factor. What was interesting is that the other clinical trials with AR-targeted therapy, the Latitude pre-selected for a higher risk patient group, and that demonstrated an overall survival advantage. However, since lower risk patients were not included, actually the FDA, when they approved abiraterone and prednisone in the hormone-sensitive population, metastatic hormone-sensitive, approved it in all comers. My interpretation of that is basically that absence of proof is not a proof of absence, hence, you know, letting the patients have access. And of course, there's more data coming from STAMPEDE. And then the other data that was presented at the main ASCO meeting and publications came out also is looking at apalutamide, which is another AR-targeted drug, and sort of the brother of enzalutamide. Both of these drugs, enzalutamide and apalutamide, improved overall survival at earlier, you know, analyses, and the data looks pretty impressive. And I'd say the follow-up is not as far out as what we have for Latitude for the abiraterone and prednisone, but the trends appear to be comparable. Now, what's interesting about these last two trials that I mentioned, so these are the randomized trials looking at enzalutamide or apalutamide with androgen deprivation, that these trials allowed men who have been getting chemotherapy to be there. And it's interesting, I don't think it's powered to look at trends. And while you look at the forest plot in terms of the benefits, it's not clear that the combination of adding enza and chemo or apa and chemo gives you a lot of advantage. However, it's really hard to conclude that. So I would say at this moment, piling up the drugs is not the way to go. Go with the level one evidence, which supports, again, the addition of an AR-targeted drug or a chemotherapy, depending on the context. There is another trial ongoing, which is prospectively randomizing patients to either LHRH therapy plus chemotherapy or that plus another AR-targeted drug, darolutamide. So that will give us also some information.
So when you look at these data and talk to patients about this, from your point of view, is the benefit of the endocrine therapy and chemotherapy in your mind the same?
I think they're comparable when you look at it. And the trade-offs become side effect issues, duration of therapy. And if I may say this, when I counsel my patients, so as I mentioned, I only counsel patients with high volume disease with regard to the option of chemo versus the option of AR-targeted drug. And interestingly, the verdict from the patient is 50-50. Patient preferences is not entirely always for a pill that can be given indefinitely. There are patients who look at it and decide, you know what, I'd rather just get done with the treatment. And mind you, this is a factor we probably should also discuss. There is the cost factor. And oral therapy can be also expensive. And so different factors kind of go into this process. And in the high volume patients, when I counsel them, it's 50-50.
You know, I've heard that consistently from investigators, and it's always so hard for me to believe. You know, the cost thing, that could make some sense, but I hear this thing about it being the duration of treatment. I think about, you know, ibrutinib and these drugs that people take for long periods of time, and really, it's, I wonder whether chemo sounds stronger or something to the patient. Or do you think it's really the difference in duration? I mean, taking a pill?
I think, remember, no pill is a panacea. And these men, generally, I would say they're older. They have other comorbidities. And on top of it, they are with their comorbidities, cardiovascular, diabetes, you know, other issues. And also what I tend to do is print for them patient-friendly language of the side effects. I never actually have them make a decision right there in the office. And generally, we explain everything, we go over everything, give them the option. And when a patient says to me, but what would you prefer? And I say, Mr. So-and-so, the fact that I gave you these two choices is because I think they're both reasonable. So it's going to be a matter of your preference there. And a lot of the patients, actually, when they go home, read about the different issues and come back, they would rather just get done with it. And I think that's, to me, what the explanation for choosing the chemotherapy.
And in terms of apalutamide versus enzalutamide, from your point of view, a complete coin flip, or can you differentiate at all?
I think that they're very, very similar in many ways. They have different kind of side effects. They share certain side effects and they're different in other ways. But I would say the issue has been, from my practice, and this may be different by different states and different regions, is insurance coverage.
But you said the side effects profile is different of these two drugs?
No, they have certain things. Like when you look at the side effects, there are different types of side effects. They share certain side effects, and there are some different side effects. For example, with apalutamide, you have to measure thyroid test, for example. There is, both of them have the issues of cardiovascular and CNS potential issues, risk of falls and things like that. So these are the kinds of things that one would need to be mindful of. Specifically, as we're seeing many, many men in their late 80s, and some are in their early 90s. They look fantastic, but they do have these issues that we have to be mindful of. And obviously, it's not like the chemo is going to be easy in these men, but you have to be really taking the full picture and counseling and then making a shared decision.
Actually, I want to move on now and talk a little bit about PARP inhibitors.
Okay.
And nowadays, we're talking about PARP inhibitors not only in our GU meetings with prostate, our GI meetings with pancreas, and of course, we've been talking about it for a while with ovary and breast. So I want to sort of track the FDA status of olaparib, rucaparib, and niraparib, all related to the use of metastatic castration-resistant prostate cancer who progressed on prior treatment. So this all started in 2016. When olaparib was the first to get breakthrough designation, more recently it was granted priority review for patients with homologous recombinant repair gene mutations based on the PROFOUND trial that you presented at ESMO last fall. In 2018, rucaparib received FDA breakthrough therapy designation for patients with BRCA1 and 2 mutation-positive disease based on the phase 2 TRITON2 study. And it's also been recently granted priority review status for patients with BRCA1 and 2 mutations. And then finally, in 2019, niraparib, based on data from the phase 2 Galahad trial, received breakthrough designation for patients with BRCA1 and 2 mutated disease. So maybe a good way to hear about the emerging role of PARP inhibitors in prostate cancer is to hear about your patient in his late 60s.
So this gentleman was diagnosed around 2004. So he would have been in his mid-50s roughly when he was diagnosed with prostate cancer. It was a Gleason 6, and he was treated with brachytherapy. He was evaluated by urology for erectile dysfunction, and this was about, 10 years later. And at that time, they were evaluating him for that, and because of his history of prostate cancer, they actually checked a PSA. And so 10 years later, his PSA was 32. And a prostate biopsy was done, which now showed a Gleason 9, 5 plus 4. So by any criteria, is a rather aggressive histology.
I'm just kind of curious, in your own mind, did you view this as a second primary or as a recurrence?
You could argue that it could be a second primary, or you could argue that it was present in the first place and somehow was not picked. Because really, you're really doing biopsies, and the biopsies are very focal in their nature. And I would imagine in 2004, he probably got only 6 biopsies.
Right. That's a good point.
Yeah.
I guess I was just theoretically wondering what the likelihood is that it would be a recurrence in the radiation field.
I think it's probably more like a new primary potentially.
I don't know. How often do you see this delay of a was he getting PSAs over the years?
He got PSAs, and I think after a while he kind of skipped them because he had been 10 years out with nothing going on.
Right. So I guess you worked him up at that point.
So yeah, actually, it was incidental. It was essentially went to see a urologist for erectile dysfunction, was evaluated, and because of his history, a PSA was done. And so that's what was found. And then imaging was done because of the Gleason and the PSA and so on. And he was found to have focal metastatic disease in the bone. So he underwent hormone therapy. And then basically about 2 years later, he developed disease progression.
One other point before you go on. So his initial treatment, was that done in the community or you treated him?
No, it was in the community.
Because this case sounds exactly like the first case you just presented. I mean, not exactly, but it is a focal bone met.
Yes.
And not only that, I mean, he also didn't get anything in additional ADT.
Correct. And remember, 2015, the latitude data was not available.
Oh, this is 2015.
2015. The gentleman has personal preference not to get chemo. And so when he was treated, and because he didn't have like a lot of disease, he basically went on just regular LHRH therapy.
Oh, that's interesting. So it was discussed with him, but he chose not to be treated?
I don't know that specifically things were discussed, but as of today, when we discussed with him options of treatment, because he's now, you know, he's progressed multiple lines and it's time for him to get chemo, he had his preference not to get chemo. So my guess is this, it's quite possible that at the time it was either not discussed, or if it was discussed, he might have declined. But I don't know for a fact.
So in any event, he gets started on ADT.
Correct.
And then what happens?
And then basically he develops PSA progression. And that was around April of 2017. So he gets referred to me, which is actually about a year after I landed in Chicago, and evaluated him, and we imaged him, and he clearly had multiple bony metastases, bone-only predominantly disease. And at that time, he also underwent germline testing, and he was found to have BRCA2. So whomever saw him just before me, because of the emerging data on the potential impact for family members and so on, and for potential therapeutics, he underwent the BRCA testing.
Did he have a family history?
He had some family history of prostate cancer, yes.
Really? Interesting.
And actually, he had a family history of prostate and of breast cancer, which was even more of a reason to do that. So at the time, we counseled him on different options, and one of the options was a clinical trial that we have. So this is, again, for your audience, frontline metastatic castration-resistant prostate cancer, predominantly bone disease only, where they certainly have several options of standard of care treatment with AR-targeted drugs. Chemotherapy certainly is an option. Radium is certainly an option. And definitely clinical trials. And he was generally in great health. And we discussed with him the different options, and he elected to go with a clinical trial that we have ongoing right now for disclosure. I'm the lead investigator for it. It's investigator-initiated clinical trial that we're conducting at multiple sites with Northwestern University as the lead institution. And the trial is designed to look at patients who are pre-selected for canonical DNA repair defect, randomizing those men to either abiraterone with prednisone or olaparib or abiraterone and prednisone in combination with olaparib. And the canonical defects were specifically BRCA1, BRCA2, or ATM. We also have an expansion cohort for anything that's not a BRCA1, BRCA2, or ATM, and this is per FDA requirement. This is an IND trial that I hold the IND for it. And so he was randomized actually to the combination arm and received olaparib standard dose and abiraterone and prednisone standard dose starting from basically September of 2017. And fast forward, he actually had a very nice response, both clinically, biochemically, and tolerated overall the treatment quite well. 2 years later, roughly around July of 2019, he developed a PSA rise and developed new hip pain, and then imaging demonstrated actually objective progression.
So before you go on, what happened during the 2 years? How did he do in terms of tolerability to this regimen?
He did very well, generally. He didn't have any major hematologic toxicities, no major side effects, developed some fatigue for which we had to adjust the olaparib dose a little bit. Other than that, done extremely well in terms of tolerating the treatment.
Do men in general with bone disease particularly have more cytopenias with PARP inhibitors or olaparib than, you know, patients with other cancers, for example?
I think that based on the PROFOUND trial, potentially I would say patients who are heavily pretreated, which implies they have really pretty much severe cancer, where the marrow could have been both damaged by a combination of the cancer and the treatment, you may see more myelosuppression. However, I would say in this particular trial, because this is frontline patients, we have not really seen any major, you know, hematologic issues thus far.
So you mentioned the fact that he's BRCA2. Can you talk a little bit about, I guess, the genomic signature of prostate cancer? You know, I did a program with Emmanuel Antonarakis, and he was joking that it should be called P-RACA instead of BRCA, because prostate is more BRCA-like than breast. But anyhow, I wasn't aware that BRCA2 is actually more common in prostate.
Yes, it's actually quite high. And I would like to refer your audience to the Stand Up to Cancer publication, first author Robinson. This was published in Cell, I want to say, in 2015 or so. So this is a project that was a multi-institutional East Coast International Dream Team, so to speak. And that was the name of the team when the whole concept was designed. At the time when the research occurred, men with metastatic castration-resistant prostate cancer underwent fresh tumor biopsies and they underwent genomic testing. And what was interesting is this, is that 90 plus of these men actually had some kind of genomic alteration. It was amazing when you look at it, which tells me that prostate cancer is incredibly heterogeneous. And in that cohort, again, this is metastatic disease patients, castration-resistant disease, over 20% of them have actually alterations in the DNA repair pathway. And so the most frequent was actually BRCA2. So when we look at, say, the PROFOUND data, BRCA2 also extremely common in there. So I do absolutely agree with Emmanuel. I think there is a lot that there is for us to learn about prostate cancer and its genomics.
So I would like to hear about the PROFOUND trial, but before you get into that, I was just kind of flashing on the things I've been hearing in ovary about multiplex somatic testing versus germline panel. And I came away with ovary with the feeling that, well, theoretically, you should do both if you want to capture everybody, that you miss some if you just do germline. You actually miss, according to them, miss some germline if you just do somatic. Is that the case with prostate?
Yeah, I think you miss a lot if you end up doing just germline. And so when we designed the PROFOUND trial, this was based on tissue genomics. We also looked at germline. And I think that part of the reason, if in fact the intent is therapy perspective, then I would say the somatic or the tumor tissue will give you what you need to make a decision. Because if there is no expression, there's no expression. That means there's no germline and there's no somatic. One thing I want to caution your audience about, I did not realize it, but discovered it indirectly, that if a patient has not been consented for germline testing and only tissue was submitted for tumor testing, that if in fact a BRCA-like alteration was identified, since the patient has not been consented for germline, and since this could be germline, some laboratories may not report it. And I discovered that sort of the indirect way. And this has to do with the laws and privacy issues.
Wow.
So I would encourage people to kind of be up to date on this issue. And I don't know if it applies today, but this actually hit my radar screen 2 years ago. And when I looked into it and I specifically contacted the lab that did the testing, and they said, well, because we don't know if this is germline or not, and because this is BRCA, and because of the potential implications, the lab did not report it.
Wow.
And so I would say, again, this has to do with the legalities, nothing to do with medicine. But I would encourage also the audience to verify that up front.
Hmm. That's really interesting.
Yes, so that's the case. And I would say in a trial that we are doing, and we're looking at genomics, there's no question that there are many more cases that are somatic but not germline. And so I think in prostate cancer right now, from a therapy perspective, go with the tumor tissue. But if you have data already from germline, then that's easy. You could use that data if, in fact, it shows that there is an appropriate mutation or alteration that you could use for therapy. We do at our center encourage patients to also undergo germline testing because of the potential implications to blood relatives.
So one other testing question before we start getting into the clinical data. Another sort of area, at least confusion for me, is you hear about homologous recombination repair defects where you look in the tissue. So are those mutations, though?
So the DNA repair defect, that's why I tend to use that lingo as opposed to HRR, is because it's more of a blanket, because there are different other alterations that could be potentially qualifying the patient for PARP inhibitors. So what I would tell physicians and colleagues is that if you have a question and you're not really clear on the lingo that has been reported, is to consult with your molecular pathology colleague or other colleagues who are more experts on sort of the genomics aspect. Because I have to say, it's getting more complicated. And even for somebody who is in the field, I find myself asking, you know, a molecular pathologist, is this something that's actionable or not? Is this something that is, you know, clinically relevant or not?
So let's talk about the PROFOUND trial just presented now at the ESMO meeting. Before you get into that, can you talk about what we knew about PARP inhibitor activity prior to this study?
So if I may begin maybe with earlier data going back to 10 plus years ago, where there was emerging preclinical data looking at the collaborative cooperation, I want to say, between AR targeting and PARP inhibition, or the creation of synthetic lethality in the context of, you know, the use of an alkylator and then using a PARP inhibitor. The data in prostate cancer preclinically, one of the very interesting set of data came out of Dr. Karen Knudsen's laboratory, and I want to say published around 2010, 2011, definitely was presented at AACR, as I recall, that suggested in hormone-sensitive tumor models, co-targeting AR and DNA repair pathways with a PARP inhibitor, in fact, could give you a synergistic effect. Essentially, what I would interpret as kind of creating a synthetic lethality. This was not specifically in like BRCA defective type tumor types. There was also work on the use of alkylators and then adding a PARP inhibitor with the idea that you're creating DNA damage and then trying to inhibit repair with the PARP inhibitor. So all of that preclinical work. We started a clinical trial based on the concept of co-targeting AR and DNA repair. And this was an NCI-funded multi-site trial where we looked at patients with abiraterone and prednisone, or abiraterone, prednisone, and veliparib, which is another PARP inhibitor. And we stratified these men by the presence or absence of ETS gene fusions. This is TMPRSS2 ERG gene fusions that preclinically there was data suggesting that they may make the patient's tumors more susceptible to combination treatment. At the end of that trial, what we found was something very interesting, was that the combination did not seem to have an overall much better advantage over, you know, AR targeting alone. But we found that men who had actually DNA repair defect, and these are men whose tumors were tested under the umbrella of the standard to cancer that I was mentioning to you earlier, these men did much better whether they were on AR-targeted drug alone or with the combination treatment, which was fascinating, again, raising a flag regarding the potential sensitivity of these tumors to AR targeting. In the meantime, there was other trials ongoing where the tumors were tested also under the stand-up to cancer with olaparib. And this is TOPARP-A, which actually was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, where men who had been heavily pretreated with other kind of standard of care treatment who had metastatic castration-resistant disease were given olaparib. And interestingly, basically, the majority of patients who actually end up having DNA repair defects appear to respond to the treatment. And a minority of patients who were intact tumors might have responded, raising the flag again that we were seeing certain signals. So several years ago, an advisory board was put together to discuss where do we go moving forward based on the totality of the data we had with regard to PARP inhibitors and prostate cancer. And PROFOUND was sort of the product of that meeting, where we basically felt that it is time to pre-select patients. Proof of the principle, which is that a PARP inhibitor has activity in the context of what I would say clinically meaningful activity in the context of patients with tumors that have DNA damage response defect. And basically, PROFOUND was designed that way. We also wanted to make sure, because this is an area of uncharted waters, so to speak, we wanted to make sure that this is more in the second, third line as opposed to front line, because by then we had really active agents and we didn't want to test that concept frontline. And so PROFOUND was designed to look at men who had metastatic castration-resistant prostate cancer that had progressed at least on one prior AR-targeted therapy, but it allowed multiple AR-targeted therapies. It also allowed prior chemotherapy for these patients. And there was a randomization. The patient's tumors were tested. The majority of them had primary tumor tissue that was tested. Some underwent biopsy, but the fundamental backbone of the project was actually tissue-based genomics. And the patients who had then DNA repair defects that fit within a 15-panel DNA repair defect pathways were selected. Because there was more data with PARP inhibitors in patients with BRCA1, BRCA2, and ATM, we created two cohorts. One is the BRCA1, BRCA2, and ATM. That's cohort A. And then cohort B was any other DNA repair defect alterations in there, partly because we had no real definitive data on whether a PARP inhibitor will be very active in these patient population. The patients were randomized 2-to-1 in favor of olaparib. And then radiographic progression-free survival by independent central review was the primary endpoint. And I should point out that all patients who were on the control arm of AR-targeted drug based on their physician's choice had the chance to actually cross over to active treatment upon progression. The testing was done through Foundation, a special panel that was companion diagnostic there. And the patients that were, again, pre-selected based on the 15 gene panel, the men were also stratified by prior exposure to chemotherapy or not. And as I mentioned, this was a fairly heavily pretreated patient population where everyone obviously had an AR-targeted therapy for castration-resistant disease. Many patients had both seen Enza and Abby, and over 60% of the patients have seen chemotherapy, and I believe somewhere about a fifth of the patients have seen both taxane and cabazitaxel. So a fairly heavily pretreated patient population.
Could I just clarify this Foundation assay? So this wasn't the Foundation 1 assay? It was a specific?
No, it's a modified assay.
Okay. So can you talk about the results?
Yes. So basically, the design of the trial was based on a primary endpoint of radiographic progression-free survival. And the results basically showed that there is almost over doubling of the radiographic progression-free survival in the primary cohort, which is BRCA1, 2, and ATM. And then there was also improvement in radiographic progression-free survival in the overall cohort. And with regard to other secondary endpoints, time to pain progression was significantly delayed. In fact, the median has not been reached in the primary cohort with regard to that, as opposed to the control arm. Measurable disease response was also much higher in the olaparib arm. Time to disease progression obviously is much better in the overall and in the primary cohort. And we began seeing actually very interesting and encouraging trends on overall survival. And while the p-value on the surface appears significant, it's not mature yet. So we would need to wait actually for enough events, which we anticipate will occur perhaps around middle of next year.
Response is always tricky with prostate cancer, but what about response rates?
That's why when we designed this study, we designed it based on a progression-free survival endpoint. But the response rate was in the context of patients who had measurable disease. And the measurable disease was like 30%+ compared to, I want to say, 2 or 3%.
What was the response rate?
It was 33%.
Versus in the control group, what?
Well, like a few percentages. It wasn't high.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, do you sort of view this as olaparib versus control placebo, in that would you expect, when you look at the control group, do you expect any benefit there?
So that's an excellent question. So there's two things I'm going to bring up. One of them is, at the time we designed the trial, the pattern of practice was that, generally speaking, let's say in the U.S., is that patients who have been on, let's say, abiraterone would have crossed over to enzalutamide. Patients who have been on enzalutamide, we would have crossed over to abiraterone. And some of these patients might have seen chemo sort of a la charted, or chemo in the context of castration-resistant disease. And of course, in the rest of the world, depending on what's available, clearly the oral agents were available in the rest of the world, in the different countries where we tested the drug. And so, very fascinating data, because there has never been really any published to date yet data on the efficacy of sequential AR-targeted agents. From a clinical experience, we can tell you that the data is not very strong, that when you use ABI and then follow it with ENZA, the vast majority of times patients progress, and the flip side is so true also. And there's some emerging data that was presented from the Canadian group suggesting perhaps that ABI after ENZA does not work as well as ENZA after ABI, but that's something that I think is too early to make comments on. What I would say is this: based on the data here and based on the CARD trial, which looked at cabazitaxel in the second line or third line setting compared to AR-targeted drug, what is very clear is this, is that AR-targeted drug in the second, third line setting, whatever we have today, is not active.
Right.
And that's a fact. Now, while the people choose to use it, patients would rather take it as opposed to maybe switch to chemo or something else, I think it's important to educate the patients that these drugs do not work well in the second, third line setting.
You know, it's not that easy to try to figure out how effective things are clinically sometimes. And I struggle a lot with the efficacy of PARP inhibitors in the various cancers where they're being used right now. Like, you know, are they more effective in breast or ovary or, you know, prostate, et cetera? So I guess one of the things that we've been looking at, particularly with checkpoint inhibitors, are spider plots, looking for long duration of benefit.
Yes, yes.
When you look at that, can you come up with some kind of figure for how often you see people, let's say, who can stay on therapy? Well, this man actually was on therapy, although he got abiraterone as well, for a couple years. But when you look at, for example, this situation, PARP inhibitor alone, what fraction of patients are still on treatment 2 years later?
Well, so you know from the median progression-free survival what the rate is. It's interesting is this, a year out, there is still a respectable percentage of patients on treatment. Now, one thing I should point out is that when you look at the survival curves and the response curve, the progression-free survival curves, you see the drop-off happening very fast in the AR-targeted drugs as opposed to the olaparib arm. And this is, again, in a heavily pretreated population. My guess would be is that if this is happening in the frontline setting, frontline castration-resistant, not second line, that actually, or a less heavily pretreated population, it is quite possible that actually the benefit may be even more so than what we're seeing here.
It does seem like it'd be really difficult to not give AR-targeted therapy first line to a patient with castrate-resistant metastatic disease. So your trial looking at the combination really makes a lot of sense, because clinically or even research-wise, I don't know how you'd prove something better than that. What are you looking for with this combination? A big bump in survival? Some kind of synergy?
Well, so this is very interesting because, and I don't want to confound things, but our trial is looking at a pre-selected population frontline, giving them abiraterone with prednisone or olaparib or the combination. And the question we're asking is this, is our earlier observation from the NCI trial that we did, the CTEP trial that we ran, that the patients with DNA repair defects seem to respond better no matter whether they are getting AR-targeted treatment with or without a PARP inhibitor. So if in fact one drug works for them, right, and they respond just as well, why pile up the drugs? And if an AR-targeted therapy works as well as a PARP inhibitor or vice versa, the issue comes up is toxicity and trade-offs there. And obviously, my hope is that the combination gives you a much better return on investment, because at the end of the day, we want to really hammer the cancer. And so that, again, the study is not very large, but it will give us a signal. There is another trial that's ongoing right now based on a randomized phase 2 trial that was conducted in the UK looking at frontline castration-resistant disease, not pre-selected for DNA repair defect, but rather included all into the study, randomized to abiraterone with prednisone with or without olaparib. And then they looked at the different tumor samples or circulating DNA type things to look at whether, you know, the patients had DNA repair defects or not. That trial overall showed the combo of a PARP inhibitor and AR targeting is better than AR targeting alone. That then led to a phase 3 trial that is ongoing right now with a combination with olaparib.
So another question, you know, again, thinking about an oncologist listening to ovary people, breast people, pancreas people that comes up is, what about platinum? That's where you guys sort of drop out a little bit.
Well, so you're right, but we're catching up. So prostate seems always like lags behind, and then we try to catch up. So,
and then you go ahead.
We go ahead, exactly. So platinum, I think this is a great question. And the story of platinum in the context of patients with DNA repair defect or bad features alone or in combination with a taxane has been ongoing right now, I want to say, for many years. Not a decade, but give and take. We're almost there. And there is some emerging data, but there's really nothing conclusive. And the issue, I think, with it is you really need definitive trials. There is the feeling, based on other diseases, that if a patient had a DNA repair defect, that they're likely to respond to a platinum. And I think that would be theoretically and early emerging data is supporting, and certainly in other cancers. I honestly don't think we have the kind of level of evidence yet to say that this should be the practice.
So, and I don't know whether we will get the evidence, but maybe you can take a guess if I say, if when we do a conference for general medical oncologists and we present a case of metastatic breast cancer with a BRCA germline mutation, how do you think most general medical oncologists say they're going to treat the patient in terms of how they're going to use a PARP inhibitor?
You mean in breast cancer?
Yeah, so they could give monotherapy, which is what all the trials did in breast cancer. They don't do that. They give platinum, and then they give PARP maintenance, although it's never even been studied in breast cancer. So they're buying into the ovary model. Is that model ever going to come to prostate cancer? I guess not.
We cannot assume benefit. I think those of us who have been, again, like yourself in the field for many years now, recognize that things that seem to make sense and logical at the end of the day when you test it, even after having very early, very promising data, the results are not positive. So I would caution physicians in terms of improvising, I call it, because the potential for benefit is there, but there is the potential of harm. And the question comes up is, we have the responsibility to ensure minimizing the harm.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't think people are going to do that in prostate. I mean, breast, there's a lot of data with platinum, so it's a lot easier to sort of make that jump.
Yes.
But, you know, I think when people look at these curves here from this study, you know, the question's going to be, well, what does this mean in terms of practice? You know, is this going to be approved? Am I going to be able to use it? And it looks like it would have a fairly straightforward application. Maybe not, actually, because even at a BRCA germline patient with metastatic prostate, I'm assuming that right now, if you could, you know, say give olaparib to anybody, I'm assuming you would not give it first line. You would give AR-targeted therapy, right, or not?
Well, I give it as a targeted treatment in the patients, you know, but it wouldn't be right now off-label.
But I mean, okay, so let's put aside the label issues. Just say,
okay,
how would you like to use olaparib right now if you don't have to worry about, you know, paying for it or whatever?
Okay.
Ideally, how would you use it in prostate cancer?
I would say right now, ideally, in the second-line setting for sure.
It seems like that's what it's telling us, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I would just highlight that, obviously, this is going to go for FDA evaluation. My hope, and there are other PARP inhibitors that I think your audience also are aware of, that some data that were presented with them, but mostly phase two data, not phase three, but there are several phase three trials that are ongoing. So I think the PARP story is going to continue to evolve in this disease.
So, yeah, in terms of other PARP inhibitors that have been looked at in prostate cancer, I think I saw some data with rucaparib.
Yes.
What do we know right now about other PARP inhibitors in breast? You have talazoparib.
There's multiple PARP inhibitors. They're all being evaluated in prostate cancer. There are, at least to my knowledge, in addition to the trial that we just discussed, the phase three, there's two other phase three trials. I think at the end of the day, my guess is that they're going to be likely comparable because they're all sort of within same space, and it'll be interesting to see what the data looks like, obviously, at the end of the day and what will be approved.
So we've been talking about the efficacy trial data with the olaparib, and while these findings are the most mature right now with this class of agents, there's considerable data emerging with other PARP inhibitors, including niraparib and rucaparib, which, of course, we talk a lot about in our ovarian cancer CME programs. For rucaparib and prostate cancer, the phase two TRITON2 trial evaluated patients with alterations in homologous recombinant repair gene mutations and showed promising activity in patients who had BRCA1 and 2 mutations, objective response rate 44%, PSA response rate 52%. But there were very few responses seen in men with ATM or CDK12 mutations. The results of this study form the basis for the ongoing phase three TRITON3 trial, which is comparing rucaparib versus treatment of physician's choice in men with homologous recombination repair gene mutations. The efficacy of niraparib in prostate cancer was evaluated in the phase two Galahad study for patients with DNA repair gene defects. Data from an interim analysis of Galahad showed an objective response rate of about 40% and a PSA response rate of 50% in patients with BRCA1 and 2 mutations. And the phase three Magnitude study is evaluating niraparib in the first line setting in combination with abiraterone and prednisone. This study is evaluating two cohorts, one with patients who are positive for DNA repair gene defects and another cohort that's not positive for these defects. Are there any other clinical trial concepts out there involving PARP inhibitors that you find interesting? In ovary, there's a bunch of trials looking at checkpoint inhibitors plus PARP inhibitors. Is that something that's being looked at in prostate?
Yes, there's a lot of stuff with immune therapy that's being explored in prostate cancer in combination with AR targeting. I have to say immune therapy overall has not been drama in prostate cancer. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, in terms of what the research is showing us and whether combinations are better. When you look at the data overall, they look okay. They don't look very impressive. Let's put it that way.
You know, we did a survey of 77 general medical oncologists. The main focus was looking to see what kind of testing they do. And I'll tell you what we found in a second. But in terms of your recommendations right now, in terms of testing, I mean, I guess things have to get sorted out with the FDA in terms of, you know, what's going to be available. Is there going to be a companion? But sort of where do you see things heading? First of all, at what point would you test somebody, let's say, with a negative family history? Would you test them as soon as they're diagnosed with metastatic disease? Would you wait for them to be castrate resistant?
Well, I think that's an excellent question. And the question comes up is going to be, what is the big picture for that patient? And what is the individual picture for that patient in terms of their disease? So one of the things that we are looking at right now, if I may share this with you and your audience, was a research project that we got a Prostate Cancer Foundation funding for, a grant from the PCF, to look at different patient tumor environmental characteristics of patients who have very aggressive early prostate cancer. So I think that you get a patient who is an outlier case. For example, one of my patients, my youngest patient, was 37 years old. This was my first year in Chicago. This gentleman comes to me. He's already metastatic castration-resistant disease. This is a patient, for example, and again, this is an extreme example, but somebody who comes up in their early 40s, and they've already developed local, regionally advanced or metastatic disease. To me, this is a patient, don't wait until the odds are the cancer is going to be, again, not going to behave well. You may want to be ahead of the game and then look at the patient's genomics for the purpose of potential clinical trials, different options. I'm speaking specifically right now about the individual themselves and not bringing in the issue of genetic counseling as it relates to family members or blood relatives or kids or so on. So I think that you'd have to look at the totality of the case for that patient and then decide what would be the most appropriate thing to do. I would say right now what I do, if a patient presents with metastatic disease, de novo metastases, and we know those patients do not do well generally, I tend to consider the testing of the genomics at that point in preparation for, but that doesn't have to be day one. It could be while the patient is on treatment, and if there's any early signal of not such a good response, then to send the tissue, because at the end of the day, you don't want to do something in a rush last minute, and that would allow you the opportunity to explore potential clinical trials for those patients or early flip to a therapy that might be more effective based on their genomics if they develop progression.
So how about type of testing? Let's say, again, we'll put aside reimbursement and cost issues.
Yeah.
So in terms of germline BRCA, do you do germline panel? In terms of somatic, do you do NGS? And what about liquid?
Right. So I am more tissue-based person, unless the tissue is not available. And so if the tissue is available and is a good quality, obviously there are times where the tissue is either available but not a good quality, or if it's available is not adequate, or if the patient cannot be biopsied because it's pure bone disease and there's very small areas that cannot be, you know, not adequate sample can be obtained, that's when I would defer to the liquid biomarker, so to speak. But I tend to send in for either the Foundation or the Tempus type panels, not looking specifically at one thing, but just sending it in and looking for other potential alterations. I also offer the patients the opportunity for genetic counseling. And the idea here is that there is that double advantage potentially of, again, if tissue is not available, then we can do the germline, but then they can get counseled on top of that. So genetic counseling generally is something that I offer patients in general, particularly if they have features where there may be implications for family members.
So when you hear about the survey we did of the oncologists, I was kind of surprised, actually. It was really focused on the type of testing they do. This is actually the project that Emmanuel was part of. It wasn't just prostate. It was also, we were looking at colorectal and breast. And we wanted to see what kind of testing they were doing. And particularly in metastatic disease, particularly as they ran out of options. And so first of all, it probably won't surprise you to see that we saw a lot of testing, a lot of NGS being used. But what really surprised me, specifically in prostate, I'm going to tell you what we saw, which was not only are they looking for BRCA aggressively and finding it and using PARP inhibitors, but the thing that really surprised me is, at least in their assessment, I don't remember exactly, I think we had like 40 cases of people who'd gotten PARP inhibitors from general medical oncologists and community-based practice. And we said, did the patient respond or not? And a high fraction, more than 33%, like 75% almost, at least from the point of view of the physician, they thought the patient responded. And we were like, well, what's going on here? Are PARP inhibitors more effective than we thought? I mean, obviously it's biased in a way, you know, we're just asking people.
Of course, yeah.
But it brought up the question of whether or not maybe even trials underestimate the benefit. You know, when you think about the waterfall plot, sometimes you see a great waterfall plot, but the response rate's not that high.
Yeah.
And I don't know, for example, in the PROFOUND trial, did you have a waterfall plot?
We did not have it for the...
I didn't see it in the presentation.
The data, yeah, not in that. There will be more data that will be presented.
But do most people go down?
Well, there is, again, like anything else, there is a bell-shaped curve.
Is it?
And so you get people with benefit and those who don't, and then you have people in between. So this data should be coming out.
Anyhow, that was one thing that surprised surprise me and encourage me. But I'm just going to tell you one other thing that I was really surprised at, too. I mean, a lot of them had MSI cases.
Seriously?
Prostate.
That were prostate?
That were prostate. They gave checkpoint inhibitors to that responded.
That's interesting, because when you look at MSI rate or tumor mutational burden, sort of the indication where the FDA,
yeah,
that blanket approval there, and prostate is like 3%, the two of them. So it's not very common.
Well, yeah, but they see a lot of patients out there and they're testing a lot of them. So anyhow, I can't prove that this is exactly what's happening, but it kind of lines up with what I think might be happening out there, which is really a movement towards finding rare things. I mean, you got, you know, NTRK. Now, guess what? We found a bunch of NTRK fusions. There were a couple of prostate NTRK fusions. They're looking for it.
Fascinating.
So this whole idea of looking for, you know, uncommon genomic abnormalities seems, I think, has really gotten into medical oncology today.
Yes.